What's up, motherfuckers?
Hi.
How are you?
Hi, friends.
How's it going?
Donald and I just played tennis.
We did. I'm hurting right now.
Are you sore?
Yeah, I'm on this real hard workout kick. You know,
you lost weight, by the way. You look good.
I got to get skinnier. I got to get down a little bit more.
I know, but I want you to know that I see that you're looking good. Good work.
I'm putting the work in. Like, if I miss Peloton, I'm going to the... I go to this gym, Unbreakable Performance. I got to shout them out because I've been going there for so long. And they have an outdoor facility right now that's really dope. And I've been, you know, putting the work in, lifting weights, you know. They're, you know, like I said, they're really safe. I've been boxing and stuff. I can't stay at home and motivate myself enough to work out every day.
Yeah.
So the Peloton is great. Cody, I love you, bro. Thank you so much.
I don't know that he listens yet. I don't know that Cody listens yet, but we're going to get
him. But even if he doesn't, I love you, bro. Thank you so much. Like, for real, man, Cody's going to, when it's all said and done, these Peloton instructors are going to be like Peloton famous, man. That's real talk.
I really want to have I want to hang out with Cody one day.
That'd be great.
I want to be Cody's friend.
I appreciate him, and I appreciate Unbreakable Performance. Thank you guys for it. Thanks for helping me, you know, start this journey again. Well, I joke about it and I say, you know, in my next comeback, after this comeback, I'll get really ripped.
Well, you look good.
Thank you.
And I know that it's hard and I'm at it. I'm working at it too. And I got to say that, so Donald is that person, maybe you listeners have a friend who cannot play tennis for years and then come back and be doing like trick shots behind his head. And everyone else that's been taking lessons the whole time is like, oh, Jesus.
You played really well today, man.
I was the most consistent
out of everyone today.
I won MVP, according to Chris, our teacher.
Yeah, definitely. Chris Crabb, shout out. You definitely were MVP today. You won a lot of your games.
I'm just in my head. You know, I have a sports tick. Is that it? Is that what you call it?
You got the bug?
No. What do you call it when you... I have a mind thing with my forehand. You saw, like, I was running around my forehand to get to my backhand because I'm just, like, in a my head about my forehand. It's fucked up. But so I run around it, and bizarrely, most people have more trouble with their backhand. My backhand's consistent.
You need to work on your forehand, bud.
I know, bro. But I'm telling you that I get into a groove with it, right?
We sound like country club snobs. You need to focus on your forehand.
No,
bro.
But dude,
and then she
I thought the fans would appreciate
on the ball.
I thought the fans would appreciate that I'm talking about sports for a second. I there's times where I can hit it fine. I'm just in my head about it.
You just gotta work on your forehand. You work on your forehand, you're golden, dude.
I know. I'm gonna get good. That was fun. I love tennis.
Great.
I gotta start off the show just by telling everyone to watch the Billie Eilish documentary. It's on Apple, and it was amazing.
I haven't seen it.
It's incredible. I don't know anything about Billie Eilish other than, you know, her hit songs and that she won all those Grammys. This documentarian follows her. R.J. Cutler is his name. He's a famous documentarian, and he followed her for a year, the key year where she, like, there's footage of them recording in her brother's, Phineas's bedroom, all the way through to them winning all the Grammys. And
I have a question.
But let me just tell you that, you know, some documentaries you feel like, oh, this is just a fucking PR bullshit. She really gave the whole family gave this documentarian such access. And it just is really special. I love documentaries and I love music documentaries. And I'm telling you all to watch this. And what an incredible family she has. Her parents are incredible. Her brother is incredible. I've been thinking about it all day. It's one of those. So I highly recommend it.
How did they know she was going to blow up like that, though? Like, wouldn't they, like, how would they bet? This is the crazy thing. How do you document something like that before you know it's going to be successful?
I think, no, because I'll answer that. Because there was an album before that was getting her insane traction. Not the one that made her a global name and won 100 Grammys. But before, she was becoming like everywhere, and the kids, you know, young kids were just downloading, streaming her song incessantly. She had a lot, her Instagram followers were climbing like this. And so they obviously knew something was cooking. So, right. And you see her, she's doing small venues, but they're selling out. And then, but she's literally, The whole album is made on a laptop and a piano and a mic in her brother's fucking tiny bedroom.
She's talented also, but he's, you know,
he won producer of the year that year. Think about this. Was what's crazy about it. I love these stories, dude. They're just a brother and sister, you know, they're just really good friends. They love music. They've been playing music their whole lives. Their parents got them into music. They're just sitting in his bedroom writing songs. And then this guy wins producer of the year, beating out people in zillion-dollar studios with all the fancy musicians in the world. And this young girl, she's 17 years old when this is being shot. And her voice, I had no idea. I'm sorry, I don't know enough about Billie Eilish, but her voice is incredible.
She's got the skills.
And he's the mastermind producer. They write it together. I don't know. I sound like I'm the press agent for this documentary. But I'm telling you, and you can watch it if you're listening and you have teenagers, you can watch it with them. There's not a single, you know, R-rated thing in it. And it's fucking awesome. And her parents are inspirational. Like, they're so supportive, and it's just, it's great.
Speaking of tennis, Richard Kine is an amazing tennis player in this show.
Well, he's only really good at his serve, but he's here. Should we count in and then bring him in? Guys, we have Richard Kine. Let's speed it up. All right, Donald, count us in.
5, 6, 7, 8.
Here's some stories about a show we made. About a bunch of docs and nurses and a janitor who loved to hate. I said, here's a story that we all should know. So gather round to hear our Scrubs Rewatch Show with Zach and Donald.
Mm-hmm. All right, we're very thrilled, everybody. You know, we've been talking about Richard Kine. Let's bring him in. We love Richard Kine, and we finally got him. What are you laughing about, Daniel?
Just the mess.
What?
I'm sorry, the message that Joel sent. I'm sorry, I know you sent it to me. I'm sorry. Richard is concerned his cursor on his computer won't work.
Yeah, so he switched over to his tablet, so he should be good. We can let him in. Okay, I've been on the phone with Richard while you guys were doing your intro.
This is going to be amazing.
I was wondering what all the faces were for. You were like so nervous, Joel.
Well, right. I just assumed she was watching Rebels on the other TV.
Oh, my God.
All right, should I bring him in?
Yeah, bring it in. Richard Kine, everybody. Living fucking legend. There he is!
Looking good, too.
What's up, guys?
Hi, Richard Kine. Richard, that's Joelle and Daniel, our producers.
How are you all? Nice to see you all.
It's good to see you.
Richard Kine, I got to tell you, we've been doing this podcast, and the mantra of everyone is like, fuck all those other people. Forget that Bill Lawrence. Bring me Richard Kine.
Let me tell you something. My friend Rick Milner and his son, Jeff.
Yeah.
Go, you know, there's a podcast about Scrubs and you call them and tell them you want to be on. I go, they'll call. If I call, that's me needy, and that's me wanting attention. I said, don't worry, they will call.
You're so fucking funny. Richard, I guess...
First of all, let me tell you, I'm very happy and thrilled to be on this, but it's so nice to see you guys.
It's good to see you too.
I love you guys. I
love you too. We played golf together, Richard and I, for a couple of holes, actually.
Yes, we did. Yes,
you're a very good golfer. I am not. You take your time.
I used to be a very good golfer. I used to be very smart. There are lots of things that have dissipated over the years.
But wait, Richard, are you genuinely good at tennis? Because in this episode, your serve is ridiculously on fire.
In what episode?
We are talking about the episode.
Red Oaks?
The episode of Scrubs that we're talking about. Did you watch it by any chance?
I haven't seen Scrubs. I haven't seen Scrubs in years.
Oh, it's a great show. Well, don't worry.
Well, let's not talk about it.
I've heard it's a good show.
Are you on a show right now? You do a show right now. Yes?
I am the Costco of acting. I'm all over the place. I come in quantity and I come cheap. And if I'm on a show, you get well paid, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. But if the guest on a show, we're thrilled to have you. Oh, you're so good. You're wonderful. Here are a couple of quarters. And then they throw them out. Like a little monkey with a cup.
Oh my God. Here. Well, here, Richard, what I'm saying is that you were on an episode of, you're on multiple, but the one we were going to focus on today, your character hurt his, do you remember this? Your character, yes. You think Donald fucked up your shoulder and, but you have in the episode, we cut to you serving and it's so good that you throw, it hits Johnny C. McGinley and it throws him against the back wall. Do you remember
that's
that?
That's when he goes left.
I sort of do. Yeah. I was a good tennis player, but that was high school. And I wasn't a good, what I had was one shot because I was a fat kid and the ball would come to me and I would hit a cross court shot that was pinpoint in the corner so that the guy couldn't return it and I wouldn't have to run. I had to win every point that way.
That's what Donald.
I was good at the net, but if I really had to reach, I wasn't so agile, but I was okay at the net.
Donald does these trick shots. We play. We just played today, actually. And he does these. He didn't do any today, Donald. But he does these things where I don't even know what kind of spin it is. He like loops around it like it's a lacrosse stick. And the ball, you have no fucking chance to touch it.
It's topspin.
It is topspin. And Donald, you hit the ball, the golf ball, very far. Just not straight, right?
Just not straight. You're absolutely right.
That's because you're putting this spin on. You hit down to the bottom and you turn it over, but God only knows where it's going to be. Because if you come over it, then it'll go like
I know where it's going. If I come over it, I know where it's going, but I don't want it to go that way because
you don't want it to. You know that it's going to go into the other fairway.
Right.
But a long way into the other fairway. But you're strong. You have a decent, mobility and everything.
But you've gotten better, Donald, haven't you, since you played Richard probably?
I've never played him in golf, but I've played a few holes with him.
Right. And have you improved since
that
time?
Do you play now?
I haven't played in a couple of weeks. I played once. Yeah, I played once.
Are you taking lessons? Are you taking lessons?
I was for a while. I was, I was messing with Ron Del Barrio, Golf Tech, this dude, David Franks at Calabasas Country Club. Like, I've gone to a lot of people to work on my swing. The lowest I've gotten, I shot a 71 at Encino Balboa. I've shot a 70 at Wood, like
all right,
all
I'm
the
gonna
municipal
say,
courses.
Those are easy courses.
Oh,
however,
no doubt. I'm just going to say,
Richard, way to rain on his parade.
71, it doesn't matter. If you can shoot a 71, 70, whatever, if you can shoot below 78, you're a good golfer.
Well, the best I've played at a harder course like Rustic Canyon, I shot a 81 at Rustic.
Yeah. Oh, you'll kill me. I had children. That'll kill your game. I moved to New York. And New York.
New York kills your game. That'll kill your game.
Kills your game. I've been in New York for over 10 years. You can't go play. And one of the reasons I moved from Los Angeles was because I became addicted to the game and the club that I play at. Because you just go there and you sit, you play, you have a drink or anything like that, and I would get home to my kids, and I'm falling asleep, like trying to play with them, and then I would literally, this is horrible because I love to act, but I would say if you can't get me the audition before like 11:30, then I can't make it, or until after 3 or 4, because that's when I was playing golf. So I would give up. What is in essence jobs. I got news for you. Now that we're on and everybody's going to hear, you asked me, can we switch this time from 1 o'clock when we tape it to 2 o'clock? Well, if I tape it at 2 o'clock, that means I get out to the club very late. And I want to go play golf after this.
Yeah, you do.
I said, I'll compromise. And I'll give him 1:30.
Thank you for doing that.
We appreciate that. I know how important.
I'm kidding. I'm not kidding.
No, you're not.
No, you're not kidding. It's fine. Donald's as addicted.
I know how important it is. I know how important it is.
And it's still not daylight savings time yet. If it were, and I could play it all 8:30, but the sun goes down now at 6:15.
All right, Richard, we got to ask you, because we always ask people when they come on, we got to go back to the beginning. Let's start at the very beginning. A very good
place to start.
How did you, you don't have to go like give us the novel version, but give us the cliff notes. How did you get started in being a working successful actor? Because you've been in 9 zillion things. very fancy filmmakers and very fancy showrunners love you and continue to cast you. And you have a career that actors would dream of because you've had such longevity.
I will tell you, I'm going to be humble and bragging at the same time.
Go.
I am the luckiest man in show business. Because when I was a kid, Archie Bunker and Adam West were two of the biggest stars and heroes of who I wanted to be. Oh, my God. Carol O'Connor was magnificent, not just as Archie Bunker, but I knew his stuff before. And he got pigeonholed into being Archie Bunker.
Mm-hmm.
One of the most magnificent actors, you would never guess it. Adam West certainly was only Batman. And it was my goal as an actor to not be them or not have their career. I wanted to be in as many things as I possibly could in everything. I mean, I know you've done Broadway. I've done lots of shows on Broadway. And I, before the pandemic, would be in a show a year somewhere. You know, nobody sees it, you know, because it's a limited audience, but it's theater. So I wanted to be in as many things as I could. And when I was on Spin City, everybody was going, oh, you're going to be the breakout character. You'll be the breakout character. And I didn't have any publicity. I did not want to be known as Paul Lasseter. So I didn't do a lot of publicity or anything. And I know this sounds crazy. I have the career that I wanted. I really do. I've done opera. I do radio. I do sitcoms. I'm doing a movie coming up in New Mexico where it is not funny at all. And I'm playing a gangster. It's fantastic.
Yeah.
The only thing is that with more fame comes picking of roles. I can pick and choose roles. I'll get offered more roles or at least get to audition for more roles because being a star makes a project that much more easy to finance. And I'm not exactly a star. I mean, people don't say, oh, a Richard Kind movie? I gotta go. You know, they may say while they're watching it, oh, I like that guy, but they will not run out of their house to go see
But you're saying there was a fork in the road and you chose that path.
I wish I could say it was an absolute fork in the road. It was not.
It was a realization.
For example, you're on Spin City. You're saying I chose not to do publicity. You could have milked the fuck out of that.
I guess I could have. I would not have been a star. I might have had more fame. It's just I did not want to be pigeonholed into that role. But don't think I could. But also look at who you're talking to. I will not be the lead of anything, of any movie. And maybe even TV show. Now, I can be a lead in a play because the economic consequences of a play aren't as strong as a movie or a TV show. But you got to get a good-looking guy. You got to get somebody who is, I don't want to say middle of the road, but somebody who is appealing that you want to tune into. Mm-hmm. I'm a satellite character. Mm-hmm. Always proud to be a satellite character. You got to know who you are.
You sound like a producer, and I'm gonna be when you talk like that. But I tend to agree with you, and I tend to agree with you as of late in my life, as of recently, as of actually this morning. I was watching WandaVision, right? And everybody knows this about me. I want to be in Star Wars. I want to be in Marvel. I even think Star Wars and Marvel know I want to be in that. I'm pretty sure of it. So I've aspired, right, in my whole acting career to be in those movies. Now, here's the thing, or in those TV shows. Now, here's the thing. What happens if I get it? Then what do I aspire to be after that? You know what I mean? I
got to change. Oh, in other words, be careful of what comes true.
Yeah.
Because you're wrong.
Okay.
You're wrong.
Okay.
When I was a kid, I had three dreams. Now, most kids want to be like Mick Jagger or play center field for the Yankees or something. Mine was I wanted to be in a Stanley Kubrick movie, a Woody Allen movie, and an original Stephen Sondheim Hal Prince musical. Stanley Kubrick's dead. Woody Allen wasn't hiring me, and I auditioned for a Stephen Sondheim Hal Prince musical and got it.
That's great.
And wow. I was the lead.
Wow.
Oh my God. Wow.
I was the lead. It was the dream of a lifetime. And I sing, but not well enough to be in a Sondheim musical, but he likes actors better than singers. And I sang well enough to do his stuff. It's unbelievable. And Sondheim and Prince split in 1982 after Merrily We Roll Along, and Harold Prince didn't direct any of his plays anymore. They happened to get back together. And I did it. And this was over 10 years ago. And I continue to work. I work so much that I did a Woody Allen movie, mm-hmm. which I'm really proud of. It's not a huge, great part, but I was part of it. I almost was with Zach.
I know you were. I have to admit, with all due respect to the gentleman who got the role, I was hoping that it was going to be you. Richard was up for the part of in Bullets Over Broadway.
Right.
Because Richard, I have to say, and I've said this on the podcast many times, I know what you're saying about being a satellite character. I'm one of those people, when I see your face, and you work a lot, so I see your face all the time, a giant smile comes across my face. If I was not in this business at all and just a fan of acting, I would just be a giant fan of yours. I just think that you are so talented and so funny. I know that you do drama as well, but when I just see you and you could say in this in Scrubs, you say one sentence and I just start giggling.
Time for rebuttal?
Yeah.
I'm kidding.
There's I saw you in the show that I've spoken about here before, called The Other Two. Are you on that?
Oh, yeah, The Other Two.
You don't even remember. You do so many shows, you don't remember. You're somebody's agent. And it was a small show, Richard. I love the show. I'm sure they're going to make more
seasons. I agree
with
it. I think it'll be back. It's back, I think, without me.
What the hell is this bullshit?
I was sort of a one-joke conceit, and it had run its course, so I don't blame you.
My point is, this morning, when watching WandaVision, I was like, why am I so worried about being on all of this? I'm a working actor. I have so many credits behind me now. Maybe just focus on what I'm good at. And if it comes, it comes. You know what I mean? I enjoy being a fan of it too, you know?
Well,
so
also,
maybe just enjoy the fandom. And
you are right. But first of all, you're really good or you wouldn't have the career you have.
Right.
The second thing is, maybe we're not always great, but we're never bad anymore because we've been around.
Right.
You've done how many episodes of Scrubs did you do?
Over 100 and something. And
if
then
you're not good,
hundreds
if you're
of
not
episodes,
good by now,
right.
Yeah,
right.
If you don't know how to work a camera, if you don't know how to get the tone of a scene or parse a script and deliver what the writer wants, well, you then
what was I thinking? What was I doing? Right. I'm an idiot then, if that's the case.
You are.
After all
I'm saying.
Time. You're
you
absolutely right. Right.
So you can get into something and you've got a career that a backlog of stuff that people can say, oh, he's more than just this. And my friend, Michael Boatman, you know, Michael Boatman.
He was on Scrubs, of course.
He says, we are at the point in our career, of which you guys are certainly, that we will always be better than good. We will always deliver. There might be some who will be great and there might, who will be better. There might be certain roles that we will be great in and we were not able to achieve greatness, but we will always deliver because we're good. We're just good. It's not that we were, some people are just blessed. You know, some people, you know, people with a smoldering lust and sexuality. I
like
do not
you.
Have that.
I disagree.
Okay. However, but those are gifts somehow. But we have amassed a talent and a credibility and a facility of how to do our job. And we'll just be fine.
Do you That's still have the hunger, Richard? Like when someone says we want you to read and you get the script and it's a really good part, do you find yourself going, oh shit, I want to work on this one. I really want this.
All right, I got a couple of answers for you. Yes, I do. And it's the silliest thing that makes me jump up and down. because I was, as of this time, I was offered something yesterday that was more money than I've ever made in my life.
Wow. Congratulations.
More money than ever. I don't make that much, but this was more money, and I turned it down because 2 weeks in quarantine and then being on the set of a very good script, but I was parsley. I was the overpaid extra. I had one decent scene that was maybe a page and a half, 2 pages. Otherwise, I'm just part of a dinner family where I have one line.
And you got to be away from your family for that.
And I would kill myself.
Yeah.
And that would really make me unhappy. It would have made me unhappy, forgive me, in Bullets Over Broadway, because that was, I didn't have a song, and the part was really chopped down from what it was in the movie. And although I happen to love the production.
Well, didn't they give him the song at the end, the banana song?
No, that banana song was started by somebody else. But and also the thing with that contract was, I didn't know if you were...
It was a year and a half.
You would have been... No, it was a year. Everyone, no matter who you were, you had to sign up for a year.
Right.
And I was like, what? A year? And I was gonna pass on it because I was... But my friend was like, bro, like, what are you talking about? You're not going to pass on starring in a Woody Allen Broadway musical.
Right? And a Stroman musical.
And Susan Stroman, yeah.
And you were challenged every night.
Yeah, it was very hard.
Truly, truly challenged every night.
You know, I was thinking about this last night. This is, I guess, a bit of a non sequitur, but I was thinking about, just in terms of the theater, and I was thinking, most of our listeners aren't in the entertainment industry, Richard. So I sometimes just explain that in the theater world, in the New York theater world, that really whether the show is successful or not comes down to the review of the New York Times.
It used to. It doesn't anymore, but it used to.
Okay. Well, all I'll tell you is
for Bullets Over Broadway, it did.
I got to tell you that Bullets Over Broadway was supposed to run. My contract was for a year, and Richard, I'm sure you've been through this, and Donald's done theater too, but you're playing to preview houses, meaning the critics aren't allowed to come yet. You're working out the kinks. We're playing to sold-out houses in a giant theater. It was like a 2,700-seat theater, sold out, that we have to stop the show because they're laughing so hard. There was one moment they would give it – for Nick, for the late, great Nick Cordero, they would give a standing ovation in the middle of the show for a dance number. We were on fire. We open that night. The night you open it, like midnight, the reviews come out. The Times didn't destroy it, but was meh. And the next night, it was like golfers' claps.
Yeah.
Everyone, this is what's so fucked up about it. Everyone coming into that theater now went, oh, this isn't that good because Brent Brantley didn't love it. And
it's
now
true.
We're going to watch it differently. And you,
that
if you're in the play, you're like, what the fuck happened? We haven't changed anything.
You're right.
But they had just been conditioned that this is not good. Yeah.
It's horrible. In fact, what it is, what it really is a review could make or break the success of a play, but now a review can make or break the audience's attitude towards a play.
Yes.
And that's horrible.
It's because I love the theater.
Horrible.
It's my favorite thing in the world, and I get so much joy out of it. I never read a review before I go because I want to experience the play anew. Of course, if you're into the theater community, you hear the buzz of, oh, everyone's talking about this show. But the last thing I want is someone telling me, oh, this scene sucks. It's funny. There was one big number. There was a hot dog number, if you recall. And it was so silly. They were dancing hot dogs. It was all about, it was just a giant dick joke but it was hilarious. And the audience would be, you could look and you'd see them holding their bellies. And that next night it was like,
that's just terrible. It's terrible. Yeah. Well, they certainly had it out for Woody.
Yeah.
But what's unusual is they had it out for Stroh. And she doesn't deserve that.
Yeah, I think that Susan Stroman, if for those of you not in the know, is very, very A-list, a huge musical theater director in New York. And she, her first giant hit, I believe, Richard, was The Producers, right?
It was The Producers, yeah.
Yeah. And it almost felt like there was animosity towards her, like, how dare you be
Absolutely.
That successful?
Yeah. Absolutely, yeah. And she works the hardest. You've never met anybody so loyal. She does everything from ballet to opera to to the musicals. She's great. She even did the movie of the producers, which did deserve the dreadful reviews it got. However, she is great.
You did the producers, first. Didn't you?
I did on Broadway and at the Hollywood Bowl.
Wow.
I have a question.
Go ahead.
What is this rule, though? Now, I don't like, this is the one thing I do not like about Broadway. If you revive,
How dare you?
The only
Broadway
thing,
you're talking about.
Yes. These people need our support right now, not any criticism. Absolutely.
This is the only thing. When it comes to Tony Awards, how come somebody like, let's say Zach did Bullets Over Broadway and he wins the Tony for Bullets Over Broadway, then leaves. Then somebody else comes in and does Bullets Over Broadway.
That's a good question.
How come they can't win?
Why can't that person win?
Yeah.
Why can't that person win? So what if they, Zach won? His ego isn't going to be hurt if that person wins, if that person gets nominated.
There
sometimes
is talk.
The replacement is even better.
Yeah,
sometimes
and there is talk.
It is that.
There is talk, Richard, I at least heard, but you might know, of them creating a category for best replacement, right?
I believe that should be done. However, every once in a while, there is simply a role that you just can't beat.
Right.
Like if Fiddler on the Roof is going to go on, Tevye's always going to win, or Max Bialystock and the producers, they're always going to win because it's the role.
Right.
Oh, and I see.
Also,
but sometimes, Richard, what you're saying is true, that and with no disrespect to the person that originated the role, someone might come in and be like revelatory.
Absolutely.
And Donald's
right. I was talking
right.
about this the other day. Somebody said his most exciting theater experiences was seeing Richard Burton do the original cast of Equus. I said, Richard Burton did not create the role, but he did go into it. And my guess is he was better than the original guy because he was Richard Burton.
Yeah.
Donald, I think you are correct. I don't think it's a bad thing. You shouldn't take away from the five original nominees because putting up a show, sometimes what they do helps create the character as so good.
Yeah.
But once the character is established, you are right. But you can win it for a revival.
That's the only way it can happen, though. Yeah. But then it has to
be. Hey, let's talk about TV.
I like the revival also because it still has to go through the same work that the original did. You got to start at small theater, then it has to get to a bigger theater. I like that.
Exactly.
I could talk. By the way, we've decided this episode is called The Conversation with Richard Kind because that's what it is, everybody. And I could talk to you about so many things. You're so knowledgeable about a lot of things.
One thing that I want to get to.
Pause. This is called a tease. We're going to be right back after this break.
But I have something to say.
I know, but I'm teasing the audience.
I'll do what you want.
I'm doing a drive-by of their proverbial genitalia, and we'll be right back. And we're back. Kind. Go ahead. What were you saying, Richard Kind?
Well, I'm full because I just had a huge meal. And now after that break, geez Louise.
I hope that you remember what you were going to say.
Okay. What I wanted to say, I mean, you talked about, do I get excited about a script or excited about a part? Yes, I do. You certainly do. Or you pray that you have an opportunity to play that part. I'm going to say something that might be interesting to you guys. I'm one of the idiots that likes auditioning.
Really? Why?
What?
There's a couple of reasons. Number one, as an actor, I like to play all different kinds of roles. I may not be hired, but for 10 minutes, I got to play that role. And I can't do it alone in the bathroom. I'm not going to invite friends over and go, hey, listen to me do this. Listen to me do Willie Loman. I'll give you a sandwich. And
although I would come to see you do Willie Loman in your living room.
I would love, someday I'd love to do it. But the thing is, you need an actor needs an audience. And even if it's a kid with a camera, you're still performing. So I happen to appreciate it. The other thing is I like being nervous. I like the jitters of like an opening night. That's fun for me. I know I'm not going to die. I know that my life is not on the line. I know nothing's going to happen to my kids, but I get nervous. Like being on a roller coaster can be fun. And so you're going in front of important people. You may get a job. This could be the job that makes you a huge amount of money, brings you fame, and you might be Matt Perry in Friends. You don't know. So who knows what this audition is going to bring, or that the person that you're auditioning for may become a good friend, whatever it is, but you're nervous. Mm. Things are on the line.
Yeah.
It's a good way to live.
I never heard it put like that.
I heard the nervous part put like that. I've never heard the actors need to perform. Look at it as a room to perform.
I do. Oh, it's an opportunity.
That's such an amazing. That's such a golf analogy too. That's such a golf analogy, dude. But it's an opportunity.
Here's another crazy thing that if I'm teaching, which I don't do a lot of, but I have. When you go in for an audition, you are going, oh, dear God, let me get this role. Please let me be good. Please let me be great. I don't go in that way. I go in and I see six people who all want to make Larry David money. They all want the success of Seinfeld. They all want the success of Curb Your Enthusiasm. That's what they want. They want money. They want success. They don't care whether I get the role. They want money. And I go in saying, you have to believe this. You have to believe you're the right actor for the role. But if I believe that, which a lot of times I do, I can do this. I go in with the mindset of, guys, I'm going to help you make a lot of money.
That's true.
You better, when you cast me, you better cast around me as good as me, because I'll help you make money. I'm going to help make this thing great.
Wow.
Don't worry. I got your back.
It's a pep talk.
But most people go in going, oh, I got to get this. Oh, I got to get this rolling. If you go in with the feeling of I'm going to help you make the success, that takes all the pressure off of you.
Yeah, Richard, I love that. And I have to say, from when I'm directing, I learned a lot about auditioning when I was directing, because you think that being on the other side of the table is fun. It's fun for about 35 minutes. And then it's really grueling and stressful, because all you're thinking is, fuck, we're not going to find this guy or this gal. So what I always say to actors is, you need to, I mean, yours is brilliant and I'm going to steal it. But I also say, you don't know this, they're rooting for you. They're dying for you to be good. If you're great, they're done.
It's great. If you're great, they're going to make money. If you're good. And all you want to do is be good for yourself. They're saying, dear God, give me somebody who's good. I agree with you. Now I'm going to bring up something that you're going to hate, but you know that I'm going to bring it up.
Go.
When you were doing Going My Way.
Going in Style.
I auditioned for the banker at the beginning.
Yeah.
And I did not have, and I only went on tape, and I did not have, I remember not feeling good about it.
Mm-hmm.
I remember it. And of course you care whether or not you get a part.
I think I requested you come in for it.
Okay, could be. What I wanted to do was not get the role. I wanted to impress Zach.
Oh my God, my heart.
That's what I wanted to do. Now, the guy you hired happened to be a friend of mine.
Mm-hmm.
And he's great.
Yeah.
He's wonderful. And I, do you mind not getting a role? Oh, yeah, it happens. But that was my mindset. And it could have gotten in my way of doing a good job.
Well, I got to say that what I think, as I recall, I asked you to come in because I literally, when I'm casting something, and it's particularly a funny part, I'm like, well, who are the funny people that I like working with?
I agree.
And you're at the top of that list. But yeah, I really like, and I'm sure there's a lot of actors listening who this is really useful advice. The audition process, we've all been groomed our whole lives to be like, and we do it. Oh shit, I'm nervous. Oh shit, come on, please, come on, God, come on, universe, give this to me. But it really comes down to not walking in that room terrified, walking in that room with your shoulders back, going, guys, Let me help you. I'm here.
Yeah. Do this let together. Me help you.
But not necessarily saying that. You can't say that. No, it's through your performance. Let's just be clear. It's through the performance.
Oh, no, actors, please don't walk in the room and say, "You're lucky I'm here."
Right. You don't say it out loud. You go, you don't say, "Hey, fuckers, you better cast as well as me."
This is a good segue into, can you tell us about your audition for Spin City and Bill and how all that went?
I got a great story. This will take about 5 minutes. Great story.
You can take an hour. Go ahead.
Well, he has a tea time.
He's got a tea time, but take five minutes. Take 5 minutes.
Yes, but we're talking about me, so I guess I have a lot of time.
I'll only play 8 holes.
Yeah, if I can keep talking about me, and you can tell me how good I am, I can stick around.
Richard only has a tea time if we talk about things unrelated to him.
All right. So, Gary David Goldberg had a show called Champs. It was sort of like that championship season. It was sort of based on his life. It was one coach and 5 guys who were best friends, of which Gary does have that life. He had his best friends who were a basketball team from when he was in high school. So he made a sitcom about that called Champs, and I wanted to read for him. And Gary said, he's not right. He goes, I know Richard Kind. I know him from Mad About. He's not right for it. And I'm going, I just let me read. He would not see me. That show went the way of most shows, like one season. Then he had Spin City. And he didn't want to see me. And we called the casting director, and the casting director spoke to Bill Lawrence, and Bill wanted to see me. And I said, let me go in and see the casting director first so that I can practice and see it, because Gary doesn't want to see me. And Gary says, oh, I know Richard Kind from Mad About You. And he's great. He's great. He's not right for the role. Gary didn't want to see me. Bill did. I had a handle on this part. The only thing that would have not gotten it for me is because I was too tall for Michael J. Fox, or I might have been too Jewish, ethnic New York City for whatever. But otherwise, if they called me back, the role is mine. So I wanted to go into the casting director, and then I went into to read for Bill and for Gary, and indeed, I was called back. And I literally said to myself, if they called me back, this role is mine. Okay, I have to go in to meet with Michael. Cut back years before, when I was at Second City, Michael J. Fox came to Second City. He was doing the movie Satisfaction.
Let me just pause for those that don't know. Second City is an improv group. Go ahead.
Right, and I was part of the company. And whenever somebody famous was in the audience, we would invite them to improvise with us, which we did with Michael. So Michael and Robin Duke are doing a scene that was obviously he was the son, she was the mother. It's obvious if I open the door and I say, honey, I'm home, I'm the father and I belong there. So I come into the scene with, honey, I'm home. And Michael bounded 1, 2, 3 and jumped into my arms like this. I mean, off the floor and into my arms. Now, a couple of things. I'm strong, but I'm not that strong. But Michael J. Fox is so light that anybody's strong to lift him. And he clomped onto me like David Letterman did with Velcro.
The Velcro.
You remember when he did that?
Yeah.
And he grabbed him and went, poof. And Michael did that and he hung on like that. When I tell you, and you've got to understand how long time is, there was a 45-second laugh. it wasn't that it was that. It was Michael was so athletic and agile and knew the laugh, and he just hung on, and I walked around with him. I'm telling you.
Like a monkey. Like a monkey.
Yeah, they were dying. It is a laugh I will always remember. In my head, it's like a movie. I can see what it looks like.
Right.
Memorable. Before I went into the audition, cut to today, okay, to the audition for Spin City, and sometimes, I don't have a therapist anymore, but at the time I had a therapist, and it was a good luck thing that I go and see my therapist sometime before I had the audition. Right. And it would loosen me up. It would make me feel alive or whatever.
Yeah.
So I go in and I tell him the story and I say, should I bring it up? And my therapist goes, absolutely. If it was that memorable, absolutely bring it up. I go in, I meet Michael, and I say, I've got to tell you, we've met before. I was on stage at Second City and we did this. And this is what Michael said. And he's given me permission to tell the story. He goes, I'm sorry. I don't remember it because I was so drunk and high during that point in my life. I don't even remember doing Satisfaction.
Wow. Oh my God.
He did not remember being at Second City. He didn't remember being in Chicago. He had no memory of really doing the movie. Isn't that amazing?
Oh my God.
Oh my.
I know. Isn't that something?
That's one of the biggest, it's crazy that one of the biggest moments in your life, one of the moments that set it off. Yes,
a memorable laugh.
Yeah.
He has no conception.
No clue.
Wow. No clue.
He has no memory of leaping onto one of the improv comedians. He has no memory of leaping on and holding on for 40
leaping
seconds.
Leaping on. However, this is something I then remember about the audition. This is something I clearly remember is I had Bill Lawrence, as you know, as everybody who's listening, Bill Lawrence is a fucking genius.
Yeah, he is.
He works very hard at being a genius. And sometimes he works to the last minute at being a genius, but nonetheless, he is a genius at what he has chosen to do.
Yeah.
Yes. He makes things accessible, funny, weird. And let me get to that a little later. But I remember doing the scene and he wrote such a brilliant, funny line because he was a great writer. Gary was a great showrunner. Not necessarily, he was a great captain. He was not necessarily as great a writer as some of the product that he put out. But when you have a genius like Bill Lawrence, you can get it. And Gary was able to teach things to Bill and generate things that Bill not only learned, but cultivated and made blossom even more. But I had one hilariously funny line that I read, and Michael J. Fox I wonder if I can do it. I don't think I'm that late anymore, and this chair's gonna roll. He jumped in the air like this and just landed. He jumped in the air with laughter and landed on his leg on the chair. He laughed that hard at my delivery.
Wow.
And I have to admit, I walked out of there going, the part is mine.
Yeah,
right. The part is mine.
You knew there.
It's mine.
Donald and I have spoken about his timing, Michael J. Fox. I mean, I grew up watching Family Ties, and I didn't know how to analyze comedy or anything about it at a young age. But I just knew that he was doing something unique with his timing that was so special. And Bill has said to us that no one could hold the pause and wait for the laugh better than Mike Fox. He just knew. It's like you watch those teenage girls playing double dutch and how they know just when to go in. Like Michael J. Fox was just so skilled at just the right amount of pause, right?
He was. I'll tell you two things. Number one, I heard Carl Reiner interviewed by Bob Costas, and Carl Reiner said, sitcoms were written by Jews to be acted by non-Jews.
Mm-hmm.
And Michael J. Fox has the rhythm of a borscht belt comedian.
Yeah, all Jewish guy.
Like Michael J. Fox.
Yeah. That's great.
That's great talent.
Yeah.
He has that rhythm. And now I'm going to tell you something else. This is sour grapes a little bit. Michael could hold for that. He could take a line and make it three lines.
Yeah.
And the camera would always be on him because he's Michael J. Fox and he's the star of the show. If we tried to do it, Gary would edit it and it would all be compressed.
Right.
Because we're not the star.
Right.
And you just got to understand, you're not the star. But I would, or maybe I couldn't do what he did, because quite honestly, what he did, I've done this with Michael, and I've done this with Christopher Walken. I have acted with them. And as they're talking, in my head, I'm going, really? That's how you're going to deliver the line? Really? That's your choice. That's your choice. That's what you want to say and how you want to say it. All right. That's what's going on in my head.
Right.
And I would do that with Michael. And I was lucky enough to act with Christopher Walken. And I see them on screen and it takes your breath away.
Yeah.
They know what they're doing.
They just know how to, yeah.
Yeah, they're magnificent. And Michael, okay, and here's something different. I was also lucky enough to do a series with Carol Burnett. And there was a difference between the expertise of Carol Burnett and Michael J. Fox, who are, of course, the greatest who have ever taken the screen on TV. Michael J. Fox played for the camera, but needed the audience to get his timing, to know, to hear, to get the whole milieu of the comedy. Yeah. Otherwise, it's a straight out drama. Wow. You know, you deliver it seriously, but he was able to play that laugh. Carol Burnett played to the back of the house, but knew that the camera was capturing her.
Yeah.
She needed the audience. That's who she really played to, and the camera caught her.
Right.
And that was the difference.
I, as an actor, am more like Michael J. Fox. I have a hard time with, and it's worked for me and it's worked against me. It's worked against me to the point where I've been fired before because I was playing for, I needed the audience and I needed the timing for it to work. But then I've also been on shows. I've been on a sitcom that lasted for 5 seasons. And I had an actress tell me one day, she was like, you know, I thought you were going to blow it until the audience got in and then you turned it into something different.
Absolutely.
I can't do it without the audience. If you're not going to laugh, if you're not going to give me the rhythm, and I think that's what's great about Bill, because Bill at the audition for Scrubs would give you the laugh. He helped you create the rhythm in the audition.
Yeah,
you know what
exactly,
I mean?
Exactly.
And so I know exactly what you're talking about. I have a hard time. I appreciate people that are more like Bill because of that. Bill and Mike are perfect for each other, if that's
the case. Yes, they are. I call it, you ride the laugh.
Yeah.
Right.
It gives you a breath. It gives you a way to get to the next sentence and as Michael could do, he could either hold it or in my situation, you make a face.
Right.
You know, you're riding the laugh.
I feel like
I've got to say something, but you're holding for the laugh.
Yeah. I feel like Michael J. Fox would do this thing where he would almost start to like nod, like he was nodding along with the laugh, and the audience was him. They were in his head going.
I forgot what the
example Bill told us was. It was something like shaving a haircut, 2 bits, or whatever it was. But the audience knew what the 2 bits of it all was.
Oh, absolutely. That's the easiest thing.
And then Michael Fox would just kind of nod with them, let them laugh, let them get ahead of it. Then just pause even longer. So they're like, when is he going to do it? When is he going to do it? And then just say it. And then he would just say it and they would guffaw.
Absolutely. And that is a comforting thing. And the audience is relieved that they were delivered by such a waiter. It is the greatest. I got to tell you one other thing. A lot of times, because of Michael's impairment, which we didn't even know about until the last year, but Michael couldn't have a long evening on Friday nights taping in front of the audience. So in order to make it shorter, all of the extraneous, that's the wrong word, all of the supporting cast, they had scenes. We would do their scenes, and they were in swing sets in the back. So they were not in front of the audience. They would have just been shown on TV.
Just pause there for the audience. Swing sets are sets that, if you're doing a sitcom, aren't right in front of the audience. They might be out of the audience's view, right?
Right. The audience is seeing it live, but not they're seeing it live on a screen,
yeah.
but not in front. Most of Michael's stuff was done in front of an audience, even if it was on a swing set, because that's what Michael wanted. So in order to get, and I was in either the B or sometimes I was usually a C story that was all about me, but just took a few pages, but I did not get the audience. So I didn't hear that laugh and I couldn't ride it. Mm. But when I was in front of an audience, I of course was much better but those are some of the things that the people don't know, but it's absolutely fair. I, over the years, and you're going to say, oh no, Richard, no, I can't do four camera sitcom nearly as well as I'm a much better actor now. And therefore to be big on four camera, which you really have to do. You have to, it's the greatest amalgam of theater and TV. Mm-hmm. I'm not nearly as good.
So do you not?
By choice or by choice?
I can't do it anymore. It's not by choice.
Okay.
I am a better actor on single camera. I prefer single camera, meaning not four cameras going at once. You do a whole scene. It's for the audience. It's one camera. They've lit it all up, and which is how Scrubs is done.
Yeah.
You know, for those who want to know, when you watch All in the Family, you watch Roseanne. There is a different look of those shows versus when you watch Scrubs. You can feel that difference of videotape and hear the audience. So that is the difference.
But you're very good at that. So you wouldn't if a sitcom came up in New York City, you would pass on it?
If a sitcom came up in LA, dude, that's all the golf in the world.
He's all settled in.
Right.
I'm just saying I am not nearly as adept. I can't be as, I suppose I can. You want to know something? I'm wrong. Because I'm lately doing The Goldbergs.
Yeah.
I'm huge on The Goldbergs. And that's single camera.
I'm
huge. But the premise, the character is written.
It's all huge. Heightened.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
I'll serve it. I absolutely. Tim Hobart, though.
Is Tim Hobart running The Goldbergs?
What?
Is Tim Hobart working on The Goldbergs or running The Goldbergs?
No. Tim Hobart did that wonderful show, The Middle.
Yeah.
He ran
The
Middle. And I came on as a guest, and Lee Salicemmel, who I adore, came on and wanted my character to be a little larger. And I went, Lee, I don't do that anymore. And she sort of said, I know, but do it. And so I became larger for a single camera, and it didn't feel comfortable. The person I was acting opposite should be big. I should be small so that she could be big.
Yeah.
Now we were both big, not my cup of tea, but I know the genre. I know what it had to be. I didn't want to do it.
I agree with you. You can't, if you watch Scrubs, of course there's times when we're for example, Donald and I are both big, but usually we're riding a line where one person has the license to be the broader of the two, because you can't, because if you're both on that level, then it doesn't feel as
right.
Funny
or, and John, of course, was written to be ridiculously outsized. Mm-hmm. You know, John McGinley.
Yeah.
He was huge. With even if he was small, it was that huge. You know, he was the medic and. There are larger characters on the show, which made your show so wonderful. And there are enormous situations where if you treat it realistically, they are that much funnier. So sometimes you're acting with the script.
Yeah.
But I always thought that the audience was the third member of the scene.
Yeah.
And you do that in theater and you do that in sitcoms in four camera, but you don't do it on Scrubs.
I've done guest spots on sitcoms. I did Donald's and we did a spoof of one on the show Scrubs, but I've never done it. I think that I would, my the theater guy in me would probably have a lot of fun doing it.
It's a lot of fun. This is my experience with it. It's a lot of fun on show night. I can't sleep after a show. I'm so charged.
That's what theater is.
Right.
Every actor goes out and has a drink or two after, because who goes home from work after having all of this energy?
Right.
You just don't go, hey, you know what? It's 10:30. I'll go home and go to sleep. You don't.
Right.
Yeah. You go out and you have to let off steam after a day's work.
Even after the drink and I got home, I was still like, this,
you were still,
no
still
way.
Up.
There's
and,
no way.
And, but the thing about theater is it is a person's life compressed into 2.5 hours. I call it a little piece of shampoo. It's this much. It's 2.5 hours, but you rub it and all of a sudden it's just all of this lather. It's mm-hmm. huge, all in this little dot.
Yeah.
And it takes a lot to come down. And when you do a show, you are on inordinate energy.
Rich, I gotta ask you this, man. When you do plays and stuff like that, don't you find that more gratifying than doing movies and TV and stuff like that? Like, I cry at the end. When I'm done with a play, I, for some reason, I'm crying at the end of it. I don't feel that way necessarily when I'm doing TV shows or when I'm doing movies and stuff like that. But at the end of a play, it just feels like, holy cow, what a release.
Bill Lawrence got very insulted, properly, about the story that I'm about to tell. And I didn't mean it this way. But I used to call TV was my waiter's job so that I could afford to do a play.
Yeah.
TV gave me the wherewithal, the money to raise children, have a house, eat, so that I could go and starve. Because no matter what play you're doing, even if you're the highest paid person on stage, you're not making the money that TV and movie pays. And so I said, it's my waiter's job. And he took it like TV is a second-rate job. It's not, if you are lucky enough to be doing first-rate material.
Yeah, of course.
Yes, sir, absolutely.
However, I get more satisfaction doing plays. I'm thrilled in the rehearsal. In fact, I don't have to do a play for longer than a month. I like rehearsing better than doing the play.
I agree. When I did my 6-month run on Broadway, and it ended, it was very sad. But I remember like collapsing on the ground, being like, 6 months was plenty.
Yes, I'm fine. It's not the salt mines, and it's also like going to the gym. Getting to the gym. Oh my God. But after the workout, you're happy you did it.
Yeah.
And getting to the theater is, oh Christ, this guy again, this life again, this show again. But then you do it and the show is over and you're happy.
And the camaraderie, nothing. I think, Donald, one of the reasons you're crying is that nothing in film and TV matches the camaraderie of doing a play with a group of people.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Because you're on the line together, man. You're on it together.
Together.
If one person falls, somebody has to pull that person back, or the play's going to fall apart. Fall apart.
And when I did Summer Stock when I was a kid, and we did like 14 shows in 15 weeks, it was huge. And with the same cast, it was all a repertory company, and we were so close. And for a year or two, we were so close. I don't keep in touch with one of them, but I'm telling you, I said these people will be my friends for the rest of my life, and then they don't. And
sometimes they do.
Sometimes I take that back. I don't know about the. I did a play at the Old Globe in San Diego. Picasso at the Le Panagil. It's a Steve Martin play. It's a one act.
Sure. And with Joey Segal, huh?
No, I did it with Justin Long.
With Justin Long, was Dan Castellaneta in it?
No, none of these people were in.
Well, then I know nothing of what you're speaking.
It was anyway. So we did a play there, and I just remember thinking, "Wow, I really like these guys. I hope we hang out after this." And we do. I still talk to these guys. You know what I mean?
I still.
Justin and I, we FaceTime every now and then. Like,
how dare you?
I know. I knew if I brought this up, you would get upset.
How dare you? I don't want to hear about your relationship with Justin Long.
My buddy. I'm still close with all the guys from Spin City, and you are obviously close with all the guys from Scrubs.
No, of course. And there's people from the Bullets show and other shows that we don't see them that much, but we text. And look, so I know you have a tea time, so we want to let you go. But
we're going to let you go. Right. But
hold on, I will say, and I said this to you in a text or email, but Zach, you are a great man. You're great at what you do. But I know the history that you had with your co-star, and you are great. You were a good man. I'm talking about your co-star in Bullets.
Nick Cordero, thank you.
I'm well aware of your goodness and your kindness, and anybody wants to look it up, we won't talk because it's so serious, but you are a great man.
Well, thank you, sir. All I've done is stand by my friends, which I hope that we all would do.
We all should.
Someone we love is in need, that I think we all aspire to be the person that'll show up.
Yes.
But listen, I want to thank you, sir. It is no smoke to say that we genuinely admire you and look up to you and quote you all the time. I mean, Donald and Bill and I will be together and we'll be just all of a sudden be like, I have yaba.
I was waiting for that word. I was, because I always forget it. You remember.
Yeah, we know. And then you go. I have yaba, and Cox goes, oh, really? Have you been around this rare type of monkey that's the only person to give that to you in Africa? And you go, I have been to the zoo. Continue.
Now, first of all, that is also the genius of Bill, who can write for me, who wrote brilliantly for me, and to choose the vowels that I can make a meal with. A lot of people do an impression of me. I can't do an impression of me, except that I used to be a recurring character on a show called The Commish.
And, oh my gosh.
And I was at a poker game, and they said, are you going to be here next week? And I go, I can't. I'm doing a commish. That's the only impression I can do of me. I can't do me. But when I say the words, I have yaba, those are the vowels that are just, if you want the essence.
But also your timing. There was an episode last week we did where the janitor is trying to get you to conspire with him. And he's like, hey, if you do X, Y, Z, I can help you. And you kind of look up and there's a long pause and you go, go on. It's just two fucking syllables and it's funny.
The one that's really great is when he walks into the room and he's complaining about everything and they close the curtain on him. And Cox says to him, you know, this is going to cost you. Your insurance is going to pay for this. And you immediately open the door and you're fully dressed. And you walk.
I remember that. That I do remember.
How did you do that? Was that a cowboy switch? How did they do that?
Because
it's done so well.
It's not. There's no cut. There must have been people back there helping you, because it's literally like a 4 second change, and it's hilarious.
Isn't that crazy? Yeah, yeah. Here's what I wanted to say about Bill, and I mean this. He started with Spin City, took it to a greater extreme with you guys. 2-page, 3-page scenes that add up to a story. That was never done before. And when you get things like 30 Rock and successive shows, it started with Bill.
Yeah.
And it started on Spin City a little bit, but it really continued with you guys. He is the creator. He is the mind behind the new thing, because he was young and attention spans, cameras. That's what he did. He created that. And it's astounding what he did. And I don't think anybody credits him. They all credit him with being great and, you know, and super successful and commercial. But he did that with you guys.
I agree with you. I don't think Bill gets the credit he deserves. I mean, he's
respected. No, not at all.
Maybe now with Ted Lasso, because guess what? On Sunday, he might win the Golden Globe.
Oh, that'd be great. I love Ted Lasso. It's wonderful.
Episode 2 is your favorite, wasn't it? Because that's the one I directed.
It was. I did like it. I do know that you directed it. I actually do.
I have a feeling you two are going to work together soon. I have a feeling way.
Are you kidding me? If I'm directing something and there's something he's right for, I literally request him. I say, you have to ask Richard if he's available.
And I'll shave. I will shave for
him. All right, we'll let you go, sir, with your tea time. But thank you so much.
I love you both. I don't know Dan or Janelle, but... great to see you guys. I'm very, very happy. Well.
Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, give it up for Richard Kind!
Bye, buddy.
Take care, Richard.
Later. Let's take a break.
We'll be right back after these fine words. Oh, Oh my God. Guys, I can't stop laughing.
Dude, you guys.
Dude. What?
Daniel and I were messaging while we were listening, and I was like, it's so rare you just get to sit back and listen and like love a podcast while you're recording
ever.
It.
He's that
was
the best. The best.
So dude. Fucking good.
The best.
So far.
That was amazing.
You guys, he had like 9,000 more stories to tell, but I was like, we promised we'd get him up for his tea time.
I'm like, shake. We have to see if we can come back and tell us more stories.
Seriously?
That was amazing.
He's incredible. By the way, he's got so many stories, you know, because he's just a journeyman actor who's been in a zillion things.
Mm.
But I really want everybody out there who is an actor and who is coming up and everything, just listen. If this podcast did anything for you today, rewind to when he's talking about auditions. Mm. Those are jewels. Those are gems given to you from Richard Kine. And I'm telling you right now, I'm gonna use them. I'm gonna steal a lot of the stuff he said today.
Me too. And by the way, you don't even have to be an actor. It's about if you're going into a job interview or if you're going into a big meeting, it's about like you're going to mind fuck yourself one way or the other. Why not mind fuck yourself into like, I'm a badass and you guys are going to be fucking lucky to have me. By the way, you're saying this in your mind, not out loud.
Right. Not out loud.
We don't want you writing us being like, I said it out loud. Like you said, I walked right into the audition.
Give me this part because you know, I'm the one who's going to make you the most money. Doesn't work out of your mouth.
All right, well, listen, obviously, because Richard hadn't seen the episode, which was an ultimate blessing in disguise because we got to talk about so much more, we'll do this episode next time, right, Joelle?
Yeah,
and then come up next time. And we'll just call this conversation with Richard Kine. I want
to Daniel, this gives us a chance to do a rap if you want to do one.
Okay.
We'll try. I'll see what I can do.
This episode was very funny, by the way.
Yeah, it had some great moments.
I laughed out loud a bunch, Donald. I just have to say, when you say,
let me just say one thing.
Okay. When you're with the heavyset gal and you're pushed into the mattress,
I do like BBW,
and it's not a fantasy. She has in real life pushed you down into the mattress. That was funny.
I'm gonna tell you something right now. I love the fact that Turk likes BBW. That's a beautiful thing, baby.
Yeah. Well, I like BBW too. Listen, Donald, we have to tell everyone our big news. Should we tell everyone our big news?
Oh my God.
We're doing Family Feud, y'all.
Thanks. I thought I was going to be the get to one to tell.
Oh,
them.
My bad. Oh, do it. Daniel,
cut that out. You're fine. No. Leave it, Daniel. Listen, it is one of my childhood dreams. I never thought in my life that I would get to be on Family Feud. And I'm talking, I used to watch back in the day when Richard Dawson was like groping people. Now, Steve Harvey, one of my life goals is to say something on Family Feud that will make Steve Harvey do his classic deadpan look away. And we have been contacted. I don't know how many podcasts have been on Family Feud before. I heard that Office Ladies, but I don't know how many others. But the four of us, and Bill, because it's five players, are going to represent fake doctors, real friends on Family Feud.
Amazing.
I'm so excited.
Thunderous applause, Dan.
Daniel, thunderous applause.
Thunderous applause.
Now, Daniel, I know you're particularly geeked about this. Can you tell us what you're feeling?
Don't do that on Family Feud, dude. Don't do that on Family Feud.
Look, I'll tell you this. In my head, there are moments when I'm about to encounter someone that I admire or that I'm a really big fan of. And I take a second and I think about what I'm going to say before I get there. And you know that for however long until we get on Family Feud, I'm going to be running through everything that I'm going to be saying to Steve Harvey before we step on that stage, because I am truly beyond geeked. I'm such a huge fan of game shows and watching Family Feud and all of that. I mean, like, it, you know, a story from the tour bus. When me and my best friend were on tour as Gladiator, that was what we would watch on the tour bus. We would watch Family Feud with everybody, just back to back to back to back. It was our favorite thing. And this is like, I mean, I'm so thankful. I really can't even express.
We gotta win, guys. And when we come out of the huddle, we gotta be clapping. And you know to say, you guys know to say, good answer.
So supportive.
Good answer.
Yeah, Donald, you gotta practice your good answer.
Okay. Because I've watched Family Feud before when somebody said of something and everybody was supportive saying, good answer. And I wanted to be like, that's not a good answer.
No, but you got to be supportive, bro.
I want to be able to say, that's not a good answer. Just one time. If somebody says something dumb, even if it's me, I want to be like, that's not a good answer.
I got to say, I'm so excited, you guys. When I found out this news, I was like, this is a little piece of, you know, in this pandemic, a little jewel of something that is so exciting to me. We got to figure out who we're going to be up against.
Mm.
That's up. I mean.
Well, no, they pitched. I don't want to tell who, but they pitched a couple of people that are already in the slots. And or they said, if you have a team that you guys want to pitch to go up against, we're our ears are open. So I don't know.
I mean, look, I think the obvious choice is we go up against something that's very similar to Scrubs.
I know Office Ladies would have been perfect, but they've already done it. Apparently, one of my Instagram followers told me that Office Ladies was up against Scott Foley's actual family.
I watched that episode.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, we should go against
Scott Foley's family.
Scott Foley's actual family is a bunch of famous people. Really? Him, his wife, his sister-in-law, his brother-in-law. Oh. Yeah. They're all very good.
Well, we want to go up against people that will be funny because that's what make the whole show funny.
They're funny too.
We don't want a dud. No, I'm not saying Foley. I'm saying we want the other team to be funny because, you know, most importantly, we want our episode to be hilarious.
Right, absolutely. We want the funniest Family Feud.
Survey says.
Time. Right.
Oh, my God. I'm going to do you think Steve Harvey will let me touch his mustache?
No.
No.
Not in COVID times, huh? What if I put on a glove?
Oh, my God.
I do not think that's a good idea.
If you want a deadpan stare, though, that's how you get it. Can I touch
that
your
is
mustache?
How you get it. You touch his mustache.
Daniel, you probably watch more episodes than any of us. Do you know the best way to – you just say something outrageous to get the deadpan stare.
Usually
within sexual innuendo.
Bingo. There you go.
Look, I'm going to do my impression of it for you guys.
It's spot on. It's there. The eyes.
You
got to
do the open mouth one, too. The open mouth one.
I sent, when we found out, you guys listening, when we found out, I sent all these guys all my favorite Steve Harvey gifts.
Incredible.
Oh, I'm so excited. By the way, there's a Scrubs tie-in because on like episode... whatever, was it four or something? We cut to when Louis Anderson was hosting. We cut to that. We were on the show for boobs.
For boobs. Yeah.
I'm gonna go with boobs. Louis.
I wasn't on that episode.
You
I
weren't
wasn't
in that
on
fantasy.
That. I was very upset about it. I even spoke about it on the podcast. All right. So look, next week, Thursday for you guys because this is for Tuesday.
Right. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Thursday, yeah. We will dive into the episode that we were supposed to dive into. Today.
All right. Other news. Don't forget to mark your calendars for March 26th.
Live show.
We're going to do a live show. That's going to be amazing. I had a really good idea for a musical guest that I'll tell you guys secretly.
Tickets go on sale Friday. If you're listening to it on Tuesday, Friday, tickets for the live event will be going on sale Friday, March 5th.
Oh, that's exciting.
Yeah.
Now, are we going to cap the audience? This is something we haven't talked about.
Mm. Why would we cap them?
Well, I mean...
special event, man.
If there's two schools of thought. One is just like let anyone in the world who wants to come in, who wants to buy a ticket, mm-hmm. come in. And then the other school of thought is like, no, let's make it special and limit the amount of people in the quote unquote theater like you would if you were touring.
I think the great thing about a virtual tour is that everybody can join in.
All right. So just infinite.
We talked about O2 and all of that stuff. There's no way we can do O2 numbers if we cap them.
But what about the Supreme model of selling clothing where it's like, sorry, guys, we only had 1,000 seats.
Listen, our first live show.
Yeah, but the last thing I want to do. Yeah, the first real live show, small intimate theater.
Okay. So maybe as we go forward, we do bespoke ones.
Mm. Yeah, I think this. I think this is for everybody. Our listeners want this, and so we should give them the opportunity. And you know, if you don't want this, I would implore you to change your mind.
Things are going to happen that don't happen on the show.
Oh yeah,
you think?
What?
Oh
may
yeah,
be?
We're going to have a musical guest at least.
Right.
We're going to interact with our fans.
Okay.
They're going to be able to look at our faces. Donald will show his melted Hershey's kisses.
That's true.
By March 26th, which is 1 month from today, I'm hoping to have abs. So maybe I'll show you them.
Maybe if I drop a few more pounds, I will show melted Hershey's kisses.
Oh, okay.
And you guys can hear about what it's all about. You can
you know
see
what else
what
we could do
about.
As a pitch. I'll tell the audience this pitch that I think you might like.
Shafter balls.
No Shafter balls. By the way, speaking of Shafter balls, this is kind of like our OnlyFans. We're doing an OnlyFans event.
Yeah, but it's like Shafter balls too.
Oh, except we're not going to show, you know, balloon nut. I wanted to say that maybe we sing Gylo.
No. Aww.
Why not?
No. No. Why not? No. Because we.
You scared?
Like,
you scared? You scared?
You think I'm scared to sing?
You scared?
You can sing Guy Love right now. It's not
a
big deal.
That's for the special event, Dick Neck.
Dick Neck, it's not a big deal.
You rub
dick
your neck.
I'm a Dick Neck? So that means my face is the what?
Where the head. Where? The tip. Okay. And you rub your neck and you look like a giraffe when that shit grows.
Oh, boy. Oh, gosh. My goodness. Oh, my word.
Fucking look like E.T. when it grows.
Yes,
is that what you're saying?
E.T. when he's fucking like.
Oh, God.
I hope it's a little girthier than E.T.'s neck.
Yeah,
shit.
Yeah. Wow. Your dick neck has a lot more girth than E.T.'s dick neck.
Oh, God.
There go all our sponsors. All right. Listen. Let's get out of here while we're ahead. Joelle, you all right?
I'm dying.
Don't worry, Joelle. You can unpause Rebels any moment. Listen, guys.
Did you watch WandaVision?
No, I'm not caught up. Don't say a word.
Yeah.
Did you watch it?
I watched last week's.
Watched last week's. I haven't watched last night's.
No, Donald's the kind of guy that gets up in the morning and watches.
I know.
My wife and I watched it this morning because we had the kids were at school and we had a little bit of time before the podcast I didn't mean to unlatch. I didn't mean
all,
to unlatch.
That's all. Yeah, that's all.
We'll
leave it at that.
There. We'll get there.
Leave it at that.
Get your baby back on the nipple. I'll do it. I'll do it. Easy. Easy. There it is. All right.
There's
going to
be a kid. There's going to be a kid that hears that one day and is going to be like, I'm so troubled. It just reminds me of my mom's teat.
I don't know what it is about Zach's voice, but it reminds me of suckling on my mom's teat.
Oy, 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 oy.
All right. Let's end this. That was awesome. That was such a surprise.
Amazing.
And it's such a great example of how, like, when the second he said he hadn't seen the episode, I was like, rut-row. And then that was one of the most entertaining guests we've had.
He has so many stories, man. Oh. And
well, next time we got to ask him about the Clooney, all his Clooney anecdotes.
Yes.
Because
no doubt.
Clooney of it all.
He's Clooney's best friend, and he was Clooney was best man at his wedding. And I'm sure they have a lot of adventures that we'll get Richard to tell.
I cannot stress this enough. The jewels that he left were sacred. And so please, if you are in business and you have fear of walking into rooms and being in front of people, or if you need a new anecdote because the old one's not working anymore, rewind this episode. Great talk with Richard Kind, guys.
Yes. All right. We love you all, and we'll see you next time.
5, 6, 7, 8.
Stories about a show we made about a bunch of